Welcome to another episode of That's So Cincinnati. We are live. Actually, we're recording here in the studios at the Inquirer newsroom alongside Sherry Coolidge, Silent Phil on the ones and twos, and special guest today, Richard Cook, owner of E19 Bar in Over the Rhine. A lot of times when you say, where's E19? Hey, right across Elm Street from Rhinegeist. Is a lot of this
and really helping to redevelop. Like, that's kind of part of the streetcar route goes up that way, and we'll talk about that, and helping to redevelop that corner up Elm and Liberty. It's really coming along. He opened during the pandemic, so I thought, let's talk development and say happy birthday to him.
Yeah, celebrating a year in business, and I've heard great things about E19 from a friend of mine and also from my other friend, Sherry. I've heard great things about it. And so we know that you like our guests about restaurants and bars and beer. And so, hey, we thought, let's have Richard on. So
we're still us, though, so let's talk politics, yeah?
No. You said, yeah, I say no. Sherry, there's a lot going on. It feels like sometimes we can, because some of these stories are carrying over week to week.
I could talk about issue 3 all day, every day. Oh, wait, I already do that. We'll kind of get back to that next week, I think, and we'll get through today.
But there was an interesting story, and maybe it doesn't get a lot of headlines, but I think from a political standpoint, it's very interesting. And that's that there was an attempt to create a housing court that, and you and Dan Horn have written a lot about that. But that was struck down by the judges. Just yesterday, as we record here on Wednesday, that was just earlier this week.
You know, it really popped up out of the blue again. This was a huge initiative of the mayor's, you know, way back when. I wrote about it in 2016, 2017. And really, he wanted to get at, you know, the dumping and kind of house all of these kind of like city complaints, property complaints in one spot.
That's what I was going to ask you, like, just quickly, like, housing court is essentially where you have an issue around your house or
and
your property.
And like in the city's really trying to get people to, you know, keep their property up, clean it up, but you have some repeat bad actors. And it's not like those cases can't be brought, because they do. They get just rolled to all different kind of judges. But this kind of the idea was to put it in one place where a judge can really be like, well, how bad is this compared to other things? And specialize in it. And it just died. We didn't hear much about it for a long time. And then Dan and I got wind about 3 weeks ago that there was a movement afoot to do it again, only not really in public. We got a new set of judges over in housing court, too. A lot of Democrats. Rob Gehring's over there, though, Republican, former treasurer, and there was talk that maybe he could be in charge of this. One of those Democrat judges, Terry Nestor, former city solicitor. So it looks like the mayor and the city manager decide to give this another run. City manager goes over to the courthouse, pitches housing court in what basically was a private meeting between the judges. And the judges said, no. No, 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 no.
Fashion.
I'd have to say no 14 times because it failed 14-2.
And with the two being one Republican, Rob Gehring, and the other Democrat, Terry Nestor.
Correct.
Were the only two who voted for it.
I have to say, it's shocking. I mean, John usually knows like the political landscape of how things go. He kind of behind the scenes, you know, whips up support for the things he wants. So this really failed in kind of a spectacular way, but here's why.
Well, in bipartisan fashion, it failed too. Many Republican and many Democrat judges
yes.
voted against this.
But here's why. Because this is 2021, and there's a new, really, spotlight on what's going on with these housing cases and who they're affecting. And this is, you know, poor residents who can't afford, you know, to keep their houses up. And it's a huge, huge balancing act for the city, because you want people to keep their property up, and that's important. And there's property codes and all kind of, you know, things in the city code designed to make that happen. But if you can't afford it, wouldn't you just kick people out of their houses? And the judges, they were concerned about that. It's what Dan and I were hearing of, like, about who is that it would disproportionately impact poorer residents of Cincinnati and Cincinnati and minority residents too. Yeah. And so they said no. And so
in big time fashion. And let me ask you this though. If someone does still have issues around these types of things, there's still a process you can go through, right? You can go to court still.
Well, there's a housing docket and misdemeanor court.
Okay.
And you know, it is a tough balancing act to make people do this, and that the judge down there, and he deals with this all the time. So it's a clearinghouse. But you can just still bring the cases, the bigger, tougher cases can still go before a judge. It's not like they don't face any scrutiny in the court system. They're just going to go to different judges.
Gotcha. Certainly a political loss for John Cranley in a big time fashion here as he prepares to end his two terms as the mayor. I mean, that was certainly a big thing. I think he wanted to do this term, and no. So politically a loss for him. And
this is why, remember, who you elect as judge does matter. Like, so many people are like, oh, the judge races, they're at the bottom of the ballot, and, you know, people won't vote all the way down. They don't know who their judges are. There's not an RD next to their name, but it is a good reminder. These judges really, you know, took this matter seriously in making a decision and made a big decision that impacts the city, you know, without weighing in on either way. But they decided, you know, they really looked at this. They were all elected by the people.
Yeah. Great. I'm glad you said that, because I feel like a broken record in saying this, that these local races are so critical. We're seeing that. I don't want to get down this rabbit hole, but you brought up the point. And with a council race, a mayor's race, not just in the city of Cincinnati, you're seeing this in, small towns around the region as well, suburban areas. School board races are intense everywhere. A lot of times you're seeing school boards where it's like the incumbent and they spend 40 years on the school board. Well, it seems like there's challengers for all of these seats.
The school board races are really intense, and you know,
big, small, medium sized, suburban, urban, rural, anywhere there's a school board, there's an intense race, it seems like, right now. Don't want to get down that path. We can talk more about that as we get close to the election. But the point you made, and I want to hammer that home, is pay attention to your local races, to your local, all the way down your ballot, and judges. That's a great example of making sure you're paying attention, because here's the results of that.
Right.
Something like this. So let's end our political talk and jump over and bring on Richard Cook from E19. Special guest time here on the That's So Cincinnati podcast, and pleased to welcome to our podcast Richard Cook, the owner of E19. And I said E19 early on in our, you know, first segment there, E19, the bar, you know, the bar. And I'm like, I want to make sure people know it's E19, which is a bar in over the Rhine, right across from Rheingeist. And Richard, how you doing?
I'm well, thanks. How are you doing?
Good. Thanks for coming on with us today.
Absolutely.
Congratulations on a year. You're celebrating your 1 year anniversary of E19. And what's it like for you?
Well, we made it to a year. It's been quite a roller coaster for obvious reasons. We opened last October during the peak of COVID, and so it's been a series of challenges with all the different restrictions that bars and restaurants have faced over the year, the relaxation of the restrictions, and then staffing up. Getting people back into the industry. It's really, really been tough, but we're really proud of what we've done at E19 to do this all safely, consistent with all the restrictions and regulations. And now we're sort of really coming into our own, offering quality entertainment in a beautiful space And so we're really excited about that. So we
tell us what your vision was. How long have you been planning this, and what was your vision?
Well, this has been in the works for several years, Sherry. It really started from the tea dances, these large dance parties that I hosted in Cincinnati. And I got a lot of confidence and information and sort of knowledge from hosting those tea dances to actually sort of think about putting together a bar concept that delivered on some very specific elements that I think were lacking in the industry. And so I wanted to bring these things together to offer a product like E19 that delivered on, you know, beautiful space, great service, very tasty drinks, and then quality music and dancing in a safe, welcoming, inclusive space. So that's basically the foundation of E19. And the tea dances sort of really gave me the impetus to do that. And so now we're doing that. We're living and breathing that. And we're constantly learning. We're constantly tweaking. We're constantly self-improving, you know, to keep delivering, you know, quality drinks and entertainment.
You open, Richard, you open right in the middle of the pandemic, as you said. Who does that? And like, you know, did you have people saying like, what the heck are you doing? Or was it the other way? Like, nah, the heck with it. Go for it.
I think it was a bit of both. And I was really sort of driven by the fact that we had a lot of support from the LGBTQ community. Many from the community have actually invested in E19. And so, we had obviously obligations and commitments. And we just kept going. You know, our thinking was that, gosh, this pandemic is going to be over in the sort of fall, the winter of 2020. None of us knew that. And so, you know, as we sort of opened and started to conduct business, we just had to adapt. And I think that's been the biggest thing for us, is actually constantly anticipating, you know, what's going on in the external environment, and then constantly adapting and tweaking and pivoting to just keep moving forward.
What's an example of that, like adapting, like, but from your original vision all those years ago to opening to here we are a year later? Like, what's an example of how you've had to adapt to get to your 1 year anniversary?
Right. Well, so the vision for E19, you know, has always been dance is our sort of core. It's our quality dance, our core product offering. And so the vision obviously was, when we opened, to have a beautiful dance space with hundreds of people in there dancing. And so that was impossible during COVID, with all the social distancing restrictions and masking and so on and so forth. So we had to buy a bunch of tables and chairs, and we filled the place up with tables and chairs, and we had seated entertainment. We had people actually sitting at tables and chairs listening to live DJs playing dance music. And it was tough because people wanted to dance, you know, the music was good. And so we had people dancing in their chairs, essentially. And of course, you know, as restrictions lifted, you know, we were able to clear the dance floor. And I'll never forget, on June 2nd, when the restrictions were lifted, we had our very first full dance party. The disco area was cleared of tables and chairs, and we packed the space with hundreds of people. It was fantastic. But at the same time, we had to then pivot from, seated serving and entertainment to, you know, just wide open, the wild, wild west, basically, because everyone was coming in and dancing. And so our team had to quickly, you know, retrain our team to sort of work differently and think differently and behave differently. And so constant change, and I think it continues to change. You know, we have currently the Delta variant spike, and so that's, you know, proving to be challenging. So we're constantly looking at what's going on, anticipating, and then making adjustments as appropriate to do all of this in a quality and safe way.
So you've been an LGBTQ trailblazer in Cincinnati, and I think a lot of people know you from that, and now they're kind of getting to know you in a different way. Kind of tell us about coming to Cincinnati, working at Procter & Gamble, and the kind of changes that you felt like we needed to see here.
Well, I would summarize it all as a journey. It's been a real journey for me, you know, as a gay man. When I came to Cincinnati 26 years ago, I was married to a woman with two children. And I actually came out in Cincinnati. And 26 years ago, it was a very different situation. I came out at work at P&G and had a very supportive environment. So that really helped a lot. I quickly made some friends externally in the Cincinnati community and connected with some great people who remain friends today. And, you know, so really connected me with influencers and LGBTQ leaders in the city. And so in those early days, you know, I just coming out, you know, I wasn't a leader in any way. I really was more of a follower and just trying to really sort of survive as a gay man in the city.
But you did it, and you decided to stay. And so many people did, because it was easy to leave then and say, right, I'll find another city that is more welcoming. I mean, we had Jim Obergefell on a few months ago, and he kind of talked about this whole change in Cincinnati, but you did stay.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a firm believer in you have to create your own reality. And I think it's also, I believe in how you show up as a person in one city is probably the same as you show up in another city. You know, you create the change that you want. And why not do it, you know, in the city that you love, the city where you have family and friends. And I found it very, I found a lot of support from people when you create a vision. It's, you know, and it's a good vision. It's, you know, relatively easy to get people to get around that and support that. And so that happened with the Tea Dances 5 years ago now, almost. You know, I was lamenting the fact that there was not much to do on a Sunday afternoon for the gay community, and I was hanging out at a bar on one Sunday afternoon in February of 2017 on a cold, rainy, miserable day. And I said, you know, why don't we start doing tea dances in Cincinnati? And people were like, well, what's a tea dance? And so I explained to them, you know, what a tea dance is.
Which is, tell our listeners.
Yeah, so tea dances, they're sort of very big in the big cities and within gay culture. They go back to the 1950s when, you know, tea rooms on a Sunday afternoon were places to meet and socialize. And that was true for straight couples as well. But for the gay community, it was illegal to actually dance together. So say a same-sex couple, it was actually illegal to dance in public. And it was also illegal to serve alcohol to gay people. And so these tea dances went underground, and that's how they started. Men and women would go to the tea dances. The female would be a decoy for the gay man. It may be, she may have been an ally or a lesbian woman. And The men would dance together, maybe the women would dance together, and if the space was raided by the police, they'd sort of scramble, and then, you know, you'd have an opposite sex couple dancing, and they did that to avoid being arrested and thrown in jail and publicly shamed in the local newspaper. So those are the sort of the origins of the tea dances, and they sort of predate the start of the LGBTQ civil rights movement, which really sort of kicked off in 1969, June 1969, with the Stonewall riots. And so after the Stonewall riots, you know, that was sort of really the start of gay rights in the United States and around the world. And so these gay brotherhoods, they were called, started to spring up in New York, San Francisco, the large cities. And that'd be sort of, you know, gay businesses, gay bars, restaurants. And the tea dances continued in the gay bars as a way to sort of continue the weekend. And so we're always on a Sunday. And they were these large dance parties, and, you know, full of people enjoying themselves dancing.
And that's exactly what you did here.
Right.
There was definitely nothing underground about them. I mean, they drew hundreds and hundreds of people.
Yeah. They all grew organically. So they started off with a couple hundred people back in 2017. And then we hold them each month in various locations throughout the city. And I think it's a win-win for the gay community and also the business that hosts them, because, you know, we're able to bring people to these wonderful spaces around the city. And also it's a win for the business to bring a very sort of diverse population and a large drinking population on a Sunday afternoon in their space. So everyone's happy. And we've held tea dances in great places around the city, like Music Hall Ballroom, the 21C Hotel, the Hall of Mirrors at the Hilton Netherlands Plaza. I mean, you know, we're able to fill those spaces with hundreds of people on a Sunday afternoon, and it's a lot of fun.
And they grew and grew in popularity. So then you hatch an idea. You're going to open your own space, and then COVID.
Right.
So I know that has been tough, but you know, I feel like when you were looking around for where to put E19. You know, what made you choose the space that you did? Because I really feel like that corner of the city is really, you know, it was nothing for a long time, and it's starting to really be something.
I agree. Yeah. So, I love the Findlay Market area. I think it's a great part of the city, a great part of Northwestern OTR. And I think it just has very different feel about it in terms of, clearly you've got the market as the, the oldest market in the country.
Itself coming along. We just had the CEO of it on the other week, and we heard a lot about that. So it's coming along. But it's like where you're at, though, is connecting over the Rhine to the market area.
Correct. So, yeah, and so we're on Elm Street right across, a little bit north from the market and across from Rheingeist. It's a great corner space. So I wanted to have a corner bar, because I think corner bars, I think there's just something fun and cool about a corner bar. So the actual space itself consists of a single level 4,000 square foot space. And on one side, on the actual corner of Findlay and Elm, we have the actual neighborhood bar, and it's very nicely lit during the day. And you can see out and people can see in. So I wanted a space that was, you know, pretty visible. And then on the other side of the property, we have a large dance space. And so we have everything on one level, which is exactly what I wanted. If people just want to hang out and relax, they can sit in the neighborhood bar. If people want to dance their socks off, they can go into the disco. if they're in the disco and want to take a break, they can go into the neighborhood bar. So there's a lot of like traffic that goes between the bar and the dance area, and it's just perfect. And so I looked at different spaces around the city, and I kept coming back to this space, and finally, decided this really was where I wanted to do E19, and here we are.
And it was vacant before, is that right?
It was, yeah. My understanding is that it was a temporary charter school. So when we looked at the space, it was not being used anymore. And so there were lots of little rooms with desks and, drawers, file cabinets, papers, crayons.
As someone who's been there, that you really did have a vision, because I can't even imagine it being like that now. I mean, it's just impeccably decorated. It's unlike a lot of things that we have around here.
Yeah. Obviously I took my architect with me, and architects have like the ability to sort of, when they look at something, walls and things disappear. And so we opened up the space and put in a beautiful sort of L-shaped bar. We actually have two bars in the space, the neighborhood bar and the disco bar. But, working with an architect and also working with a, person who knows how to run a bar. So I did a lot of consulting with experts to really sort of think about the space and the flow of the space and, how the bars would actually work. And so designed all of those things in from the very beginning, just, to be successful and not to have any sort of rework afterwards. And so that was the sort of the thinking, to actually, make sure that we designed the space correctly from the very beginning.
Richard, what's in a name? Why E19? What's the meaning there?
Well, this is a funny story. It's a bit of a mistake, actually. So I had a long list of names, like 50 to 100 names, and I couldn't decide on what we would call it. I wanted a name that spoke to everyone and that didn't exclude anyone. And a lot of bar names can be pretty stereotypical, let's say. But I didn't want the name to exclude anyone. So I was actually talking to my two children and my husband at the time over drinks at my house, and we were brainstorming names. And I told my daughter Olivia that the bar was on the corner of Elm and 19th Street. I thought it was 19th Street. It was actually Finley Street. And I think if it wasn't called Finley Street, it would be 19th Street.
It would. That's totally true. Yeah.
Yeah, so we're at 1905 Elm Street, so 1900 blocks. So Findlay would have been 19th Street. So it was my mistake. It was, I thought, and she said, well, why don't you call it E19? Because it's on Elm and 19th. And I said, that's brilliant. That's what it is. We just decided on it there and then. And so we developed some prototype logos and branding. And all of that had sort of got pretty far when I realized that, oh, damn, it's not 19th Street, it's Findlay Street.
but it is. I mean,
the best names have good,
I like the name.
The best names have good stories behind them. So you do have that.
So, yeah, it's a bit of a mistake. So, but I like the name. I like the logo. It's fun. We get lots of great feedback about the logo, and we can get a lot of mileage and play with that and how it sort of shows up in in social media and advertising.
So tell our listeners, what are you kind of known for? Like if they want to give it a try, what's their best bet to come visit?
Well, as I said, our number one product is dancing. So if you like dancing, we have dancing for you. We have different kinds of dancing throughout the week. We're going to be offering dance classes as well. We're going to be also offering salsa classes on Thursday evenings. If you don't like dancing, that's totally cool, because we have a really nice neighborhood bar and it's chill, relaxing. You can come in and watch other people dancing, people watch. So our number one, what we're known for, is dancing. What I would also say we're known for is a really nice broad selection of delicious alcoholic and non-alcoholic drinks. So we pride ourselves on a non-alcoholic menu as well. But we have a really nice cocktail list, and we also have a really nice wine list, which, you know, I'm really proud about. We also offer coffee as well. We have an espresso machine. So there are very few bars that sort of, you know, are open all night long that sort of offer such a broad selection of, you know, really good quality drinks. And so we're very proud of that. The other thing I would say is what I'm really proud of is the quality of our team and the customer service that they provide. We get such great feedback on how our team treats our guests, and I just absolutely love that. And so we, you
and
know,
this is at a time when service might not be the best everywhere.
Yeah. Right. But we do sort of pay the highest rates in the city, and so we recognize that. And so, you know, we treat our team well. You get what you pay for. And we have an ongoing training program. So the team constantly gets together, usually on a Tuesday when we're closed to the public. They get together, and that's when we do our training. And it could be, you know, on wine, it can be on safety, it can be on a whole variety of different topics to make sure that they're delivering quality service to our guests. And I will say that even though we're closed on Monday and Tuesdays right now to the public, we're actually open for private events. So the whole space can be rented out on Mondays and Tuesdays to the public, you know, for private events. And so we've just launched our private event program, which we're really excited about, in the lead up to the holidays. So if you are thinking about a birthday party or a wedding shower or a staff party for your work colleagues, think about E19. It's a fabulous space, and you know, we'll treat you really well.
As we speak, the commissioners are having a press conference about the declining rates of COVID. So I'm hopeful going into the holidays.
Yes. Fingers crossed.
Like, I was like, ooh, like that's a topic of a press conference right there that's going down.
Very good. Yes. It's been a huge headwind for all of us. You know, this roller coaster of, you know, COVID increasing, declining, you know, breakthrough infections. I know that's, you know, pretty scary for all of us. And so I am hoping that we can put this all behind us for the remainder of this year, and then begin 2022, you know, just confident, healthy, and just moving forward.
Well said, Richard. And thanks again for joining us here today and sharing the story of your vision of E19, and love the story behind the name, and congratulations again on 1 year, and here's to many, many, many more years of business.
I really appreciate it. Thanks so much for the chance to chat with you all. So I hope to see you at E19. We give you a really warm welcome, and I think you'll enjoy it.
Thanks again to Richard Cook, another in a long line of just great guests in that whole industry of restaurants and bars. And all the best to him and his business, and really just rooting for our restaurants, our small businesses, to continue to come out of this pandemic and rebound, and folks,
they make downtown what downtown is.
Exactly. And get out and enjoy yourself or a beverage at E19, and go out to dinner. I try to encourage people to do that. So if you're comfortable, let's shift into our That's So Cincinnati moment of the week. And Sherry?
I think it's the same as last week's.
Disappointed in you today because you're wearing Kelly green, which is the color of, in this case, the Notre Dame Fighting Irish. I saw a lot of that in the stands the other day. As you and I talked last week, you were heading to the game. It turns out I get a last-minute ticket from one of my neighbors, Mark, and he coaches our youth baseball team in our neighborhood and offers me, he has a ticket come available last minute. You want to go? Sure.
So
there we were. Seize the moment. And what a fantastic experience.
Aren't you glad?
It was.
I know, it was amazing. This, the Cincinnati, that's so Cincinnati. Like the Bearcat fans, they got in their cars, they went on the road, and they brought it. You could hear the Let's Go Bearcats chant throughout the entire stadium. And I was not in the Bearcat fan section. Like, I just got tickets like on the resale market. And so we were with a lot of Notre Dame fans, and listening to what they had to say, I learned a lot about football, their team.
I thought you knew everything about football.
By a lot of Bearcats fans. And so it was a great experience.
It really was. And and I think there's a lot of Cincinnati in this because, I saw an estimate up to 12,000 Bearcats fans. I'm not sure it was quite that many. But it was a lot, and they were talking. I mean, I saw things on Twitter and articles about how, this was the way, like, huge programs travel. This is the way, UC has – fans have traditionally been hit and miss on traveling to traveling on the road to football games. Sometimes there's been big crowds, sometimes there's not, but hands down – this was a sea of red across that one, upper deck end zone.
It looked like Christmas in there.
It did.
Because then there would be like red dots like all over.
Red dots all around the stadium.
Yeah, because they had a green out, and I'm sure that was on purpose.
And I thought of this too. I was thinking, if you also put red on to every Notre Dame fan who was from greater Cincinnati in there, there would have been a lot more because a lot of Cincinnati fans or a lot of – There's a good strong faction of Notre Dame fans who are from Cincinnati, and this is one thing I want to say. This is my lasting impression of the game. Besides the fact that UC fans were fantastic, they showed out, and was a great game, and the Bearcats won. The greatest victories. We talked to Jim Kelly last week. Biggest game in the history of Bearcats football, and they win it. Awesome. My big takeaway was how classy Notre Dame fans are. Gracious. The ushers in the stadium were so awesome. And at a
all over campus, showed us around, helped us, directions.
Absolutely. And as we're walking out of the stadium, I'm leaving my seating area down to get on the concourse. And one of the ushers says, congratulations to the Bearcats. What a great win for your team. And then I'm on my way out of the gate of the stadium. As I'm walking down with a bunch of Bearcats fans chanting, for UC, and it was awesome. And another usher says, "Have a safe trip home. What a great win for you guys." And then we're getting to our car, and a block away from our car, or my buddy's car, not mine. And another car drives by with a Notre Dame fan. He's like, "Have a safe trip home, guys." And it's like,
classy.
Yes. Maybe I'm more in tune to that today because I cover politics and because everything seems nasty these days. Sports can be very nasty. Politics, obviously. But everywhere you turn there was not one negative thing I heard said toward the other team. And that's very rare. I've been to a lot of stadiums as the opposing fan. And, you know, you always get some Yahoo who says something silly or stupid to you. But I didn't experience that. I was wearing my red hat, my Bearcat shirt, and
yeah. You have your hat on right now.
I think with that, go Bearcats. And if you missed our episode last week of Jim Kelly Jr., the voice of the Bearcats,
took us through a lot of the history.
Yeah.
Up until that point, made some good predictions.
Yeah, he did. Go back and check that out. He's the longtime radio analyst, former Bearcats football player, and just an all-around great guy. So go back and check that out. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll catch you next week.